Hello everybody, welcome to this, the first episode of Media Voices for June. Summer has finally arrived. My name is Chris Sutcliffe.
My name's Esther Thorpe.
My name's Peter Houston.
Chris, you've just jinxed the entirety of summer now.
It arrived and it went before the episode even went out. Don't forget that a few weeks ago, we put out a special episode featuring Michael Silverman from Piano and Katie Vanek-Smith of Tortoise. And we spoke about everything from the difference between a membership and a subscription-based model, to propensity to pay and how do you model it, to effectively what makes a successful subscription business in this era. Really fascinating. We've had some really, really good feedback from it. So please do check it out.
And if you do want to do a conversations episode with us, do get in touch. All our details are on the website.
This week, I'm speaking with Paul Rayner. He's the digital publishing director at the Chelsea Magazine Company. We had a brilliant chat about his career trajectory from Dennis to Lad Bible to the Chelsea Magazine Company and the lessons that he's learned along the way.
Ahead of that, though, as ever, we're starting with the news roundup. Mail Online has grown its revenues by a quarter, offsetting a fall in money from mail newspapers. So Mail Online grew its revenues to $76 million for the 6 months to the end of March, which is a rise of 25% on the same period for last year, according to Press Gazette. And you know what? Say what you like about the Mail Online.
Yeah, okay. How long have we got?
Well, we said
we weren't going to be snarky.
No,
here.
We said we were going to approach this in the spirit of learning.
The effort to not be snarky is palpable.
Okay, let's start. 3% fall in ad revenues, given the current rate of industry decline, is pretty good going.
So that, and that's print, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not bad.
And for the online to grow its revenues 25% is really good going.
Mm.
But... can I point out at this stage that whenever the Mail Online or the Daily Mail make a cock-up, which they do quite frequently, they sit there and they're like, oh, it's not us, it's the other person, like we're a separate entity, we're a separate editorial business. except when it comes to the balance sheets and suddenly the Mail Online is offsetting the decline from the Daily Mail.
I'm just struggling still not to be snarky.
Well, okay, so let's take a look at this.
Part of this is the Metro, though, right?
Part of this is the Metro, yeah, which also it grew its revenues by 11% in stark contrast to the Evening Standard through kind of better than expected advertising revenue.
How's your head?
So it is possible.
How's your head, man, trying to navigate between the Daily Mail and the Evening Standard?
I'm like a dog who's in the room and two people are both calling for it. I don't know which one to go for.
I mean, that Metro thing is a great story. Like, let's actually break that down.
Yeah, we should pack that.
As a free print newspaper that theoretically shouldn't work, it's actually, like, 11% is not an insignificant amount to grow your revenues by. But that's not counted into the offset from the Daily Mail and the Mail on Sunday figures.
So are we happy about this?
It's good for the newspaper industry. I wish they weren't quite so racist, but...
All right. So, well.
Also, can I just say that actually the fact that their circulation revenues are only down 2% is amazing, because you got to reckon that with their readership, 2% of them's got to die off in this reporting period.
But of course, what's happened in the last couple of years to change it? I think the Daily Mail are one of the ones that came out strongly as a pro-Brexit newspaper, so they'll have probably picked up quite a few readers from that.
That one is interesting to me, because that to me seems to be the ultimate in short-termism. You know, you've come out very strongly in favour of something that is going to impoverish.
You've just summed up the entirety of British politics.
But you know what I mean? Like, they have, by campaigning for Brexit, they have impoverished, or at least, you know, potentially impoverished the people who are their target audience. And the first thing to go is incidental spending, you know, when budgets are tightened. It just seems to me that they've shot themselves in the foot.
Well, there's Brexit in a nutshell.
So, hang on. Okay, we keep getting off topic. Sorry, we keep being snarky.
I reckon that there is a positive lesson here in that if you have a free newspaper and you run it properly, you can make a profit.
Run it properly, you say?
Yeah, sorry, did I say that?
Yeah, now that's run it properly, right? That's not turn it into a soapbox and do a half-assed like reboot of it and then ape the FT for their economic pages.
I mean, you're putting words in my mouth there, but
we'll always have the poo emoji in the weather.
Well, I mean, honestly, that was a complete failure to talk about the DMG, the Mail Online results. Is there anything, okay, to salvage this, is there anything that we can take away from the fact that their online performance is improving beyond the fact that, you know, that is where ad spend is going and they're probably reaping the benefits of that? Is there anything about the Mail Online model that is worth talking about?
The sidebar of shame still has a future.
I think it will be interesting at another point to dive into where that revenue is coming from, because I know they've had a big e-commerce play recently. Like if Rihanna steps out of a club in London, they'll have like the dress she's wearing available to buy underneath. And I know that's been quite a recent thing. So I'm assuming things like that e-commerce play is going some way to increasing that revenue. Given that the drop that they've seen from Facebook.
Mm.
I mean, they were hit really hard by
that. We should do a revenue diversification special.
Moving on then, in a bit of a step away from what the Mail Online's priorities are, Fortune has become the latest publisher to put up a paywall. So the US business and technology magazine Fortune has become the latest prominent title to put up a paywall,
they're planning to put it up later this year. They haven't actually done it yet.
Yeah. And Peter, why don't you take us through some of the very, very scary figures that kind of underpin this decision?
Well, it's, you know, same old story in some ways. The Wall Street Journal's reporting that Fortune sold 630 print ads last year, 630 pages, and that's a quarter down, 26% down on the year before.
There is one caveat to that, though. Apparently, 2017 they published 17 issues, and 2018 they published 12.
Yeah, but even that's telling the same story.
I know.
It's the same story, right? Don't matter how many issues you put in, there's still not enough ads. And the figure in this one that just blew my mind is that their newsstand sales average 8,000.
Yeah.
For a magazine like Fortune, 8,000 copies per issue. That just blew my mind. I think, you know, we had Rob Orchard on the podcast a couple of months ago. I would be surprised if delayed gratification, so I mean, it won't be newsstand, it'll be subscriptions as well. But I'd be surprised if a magazine like Delayed Gratification sold any less than 8,000 copies.
But I mean, that's the thing, is that how many subscription copies to Fortune email does that count towards that number? Do they have 10,000 subscribers and then...
No, they'll have hundreds of thousands of subscribers, but they don't pay. That's purely a cost. You know, the American subscription model is $1 for 12 issues.
What?
Yeah, their promotions are nuts.
Yeah, they're bizarre. I remember what it was. Playboy did one a couple of years ago that was $1 per issue.
Their suck promotions are insane because it's all about, here's that word coming, guys, reach. For me, this is the pivot to video moment for the pivot to paywalls. I'm just sat looking at this and I'm going, holy crap. The bandwagon has come loose. It's running down the hill and it is going to run into the primary school if we don't get the kids out soon.
Whoa.
It's going to be a disaster. Yeah, that got dark.
That metaphor started off great and then just...
Yeah, that got really dark. Okay.
All right, so
it's going to... It's a petting zoo. It's not a primary school.
They're much better.
Yeah, there you go.
Better.
Sorry.
Yeah. You said this is kind of the canary in the coal mine there.
Chatterjee Jayaravanan.
Okay, since he bought the title, which was I think 6 months ago, this was kind of inevitable. He said that he really wanted to get this kind of revenue out.
But part of the problem with this is that the model is being put before the product. So there's this Thai businessman. He's, I don't know, the guy, he might have loads of publishing experience, but I'm guessing he probably hasn't. He buys a title for 150 million. He's looking, okay, what are we going to do with a business model? What's the primary business model in publishing at the moment? Oh, paywalls. So the business model then, you start trying to fit the business model in front of the product. And not everyone can win at paywalls.
So what, in your mind, is then preventing Fortune from doing that? What about their audience makes you think that they won't succeed in paywall?
I just think there's too much competition. I don't think they're different enough. You know, Fortune's a weird magazine. It's kind of halfway between The Economist and, I don't know, Time or Newsweek.
Mm.
It sits in the middle. I think people in the middle are going to struggle with paywalls. I really do.
maybe play devil's avocado again here then. So from reading an interview on Forbes with the guy, he's basically saying that our vision is to establish Fortune as the world's leading business media brand with an always-on reach and global relevance. Ignore that last bit, that's fluff. He said the demand for high-quality business information is growing, and with further committed investment in technology and brilliant journalism, we believe the outlook for further profitable growth is excellent, both for the publication and the events business. So this might be a matter of buying the brand name to transform it.
And I guess if you look at, like, I think Business Insider are their main competitors, and they've now put up a paywall, so it's kind of...
Yeah, but exactly. So yeah, who are you going to pay for?
It's like that phrase, isn't it? It's, you know, everyone says, oh, everyone quotes, information wants to be free.
Yeah.
But then the longer quote is basically saying that, you know, on the other hand, information wants to be expensive because it's so valuable. So for somebody who is, you know, producing business information, which is valuable in its own right, then I think we're going to see all the business information sites go behind paywalls because that, you know, that rock is already rolling.
But so if I was Chatterjee Jayaravanan, I would be taking the unique information that Fortune's got, like the 500 stuff and the lists and all this stuff that they do that no one else does, sticking that behind a paywall, and then leveraging the shit out the brand from a kind of marketing brand exposure point of view.
Yeah, this is unlikely to be just a straight down hard paywall. They're looking at all their options over the next couple of months.
Yeah, but you say that, and I bet you it is.
That might okay.
That's why I think this is a canary in the coal mine. When people are announcing we're going to put up a paywall at the end of the year and it's June, what? They haven't thought about it properly yet, or if they have, why haven't they just done it? This just doesn't make sense to me.
There's also this is one of many titles Meredith seems to just be chucking off.
But I couldn't find it, but there's a really good article about why Meredith is doing this. And it's about them focusing on their core business, which I guess is home and, you know, kind of design and cooking and stuff like that. So these kind of titles, whether it's this or Sports Illustrated or whatever.
But it seems a little bit, just from an external perspective, that they've bought this crown with all these lovely shiny jewels and they've just literally sacked all the jewels off. Like, all the massive names. They've just been like, yeah, up for bids, who wants
this? I wish
this?
I could find that piece. I'll need to look for that and try and get it in the newsletter.
Well, hang on, let's get into that then, because Sports Illustrated has been sold to Authentic Brands Group for $100 million. And Esther, as you pointed out, that is yet another title that Meredith has managed to offload. But why is this one more interesting, do we think, in terms of implications for the rest of its brands?
So this is really weird. Peter actually pointed out that there's some weird stuff about a licensing model here. But the first thing is who they've been sold to. And this is yet another example where publishers have sold a title to a I think we had NME that had been sold to a music production group in Singapore. So Sports Illustrated's Authentic Brands Group, who have bought Sports Illustrated, are... a brand development company that currently oversee management of parts of the Elvis Presley and Muhammad Ali estate, according to The Drum. So that's really, really weird. And the way they've got this arrangement going is that the title will run as normal under Meredith, but Meredith are going to pay a licensing fee to Authentic Brands Group to, like, run the editorial operations. That is the weirdest arrangement I've
that's
seen
a real
yet.
Head scratch. It's all, I don't know why, but it... And I'm probably completely wrong, but it feels like some kind of publishing Ponzi scheme. Do you know what I mean? Here's $100 million. You continue to make this magazine and pay us a license for using the brand? What?
But then it by the looks of what they're then going to do with the rest of this brand, Authentic Brands Group are apparently looking to launch like a medical clinic, sports training, gambling, all kind of with the Sports Illustrated brand.
Yeah.
So it's like a really weird example of where, like, they've almost offloaded Meredith have offloaded the diversification to, like, this brand company.
Authentic Brands Group. It's a really... It sounds like a fake name for something. But, yeah, they do a lot of apparel. They do, you know, all sorts of stuff. And you said they just want that recognisable name to shove onto everything new that they're launching. So I'm reading this.
But then that's exactly like Elvis Presley. Like, they just want the name to shove onto other stuff that they're.
You can buy Graceland branded toilets.
Graceland.
Isn't that just gonna undervalue the name of the brand?
I mean, you mentioned
devalue rather.
There's a cautionary tale there, I guess. Mm. You mentioned Playboy earlier. That's exactly what happened with Playboy.
Just like 15, 20 years ago.
No, if you've got Playboy pencil cases and shit, then the brand is not authentic anymore.
Yeah.
But then the magazine just basically becomes content marketing.
Well, some of the statements on Twitter about this were great. I think we should have a regular feature, what people on Twitter said about our stories. Someone says, I don't see the value in a Sports Illustrated branded clinic. Fair enough. Someone else says, sometimes I complain about how there's too much content, but that is so much better than the looming post-content world in which Sports Illustrated is a branding device for medical clinics. And then someone else just cut right to the chase and says, Sports Illustrated just said, fuck it.
I mean, stylists are launching, like, stylist-branded gyms.
Yeah, there's you know, the quote, is it House and Country or Country and Home? Oh, I can't remember. It's a Hearst title.
One of them are doing hotels.
Yeah, they're doing hotels. And then Terry White is with Empire's got a deal going with a cinema chain to do something for their 30th anniversary.
This is another depressing entry in kind of the ledger of what's happening to magazine brands.
This week, I'm speaking with Paul Rayner, Digital Publishing Director at the Chelsea Magazine Company. Paul was previously with Dennis for 15 years, and we spoke about his launch experience there, and most recently at Social Shooting Stars' Lad Bible. But first, I asked Paul to tell me a bit about the Chelsea Magazine Company, the most interesting boutique magazine publisher you have never heard of.
Well, I think the Chelsea Magazine Company is one of those undiscovered gems, really. And when I was looking for my next role, it came up a couple of times. And I'd be really honest, I didn't know much about it. You know, I'm a North London boy, I've always worked in the West End, and Chelsea Magazines, unsurprisingly, is based in Chelsea, based on the King's Road, and just doesn't have a huge media profile. But when you do a bit more digging, you'll find there's 15 websites, 20 plus print brands. It's a family-run business, and actually the opportunity here is huge. You know, we're in great markets, lots of AB titles, lots of really heavily subscribed print titles that aren't beholden to the newsstand. So actually, when I did some more digging and I looked into it, I was thinking, what can be done digitally here, which is how come I ended up getting the job, because I came in and presented what I thought the digital opportunity was. Because this is a business that's been built on print historically.
So there's three kind of segments in the company. Yeah, there's travel and leisure, special sports, lifestyle and parenting. But is there anything that ties all of them together? Because there's a diverse group of magazines there.
Well, it is and it isn't. And actually, if you look at it and you slightly reverse engineer it, there's kind of a cradle to the grave element of what we do here for affluent, AB, quite London-centric from the print point of view. We're covering right the way through from wedding ideas. So that's quite mainstream, quite mass market, and it's by far our biggest site. Then after that, the natural progression is into something like Baby Magazine. And then actually, brilliantly, we also cover education as well with Independent School Parent. So there's quite a nice narrative and creative art there. And actually, if you carry on after that, as people grow up, we would also be covering potentially their first or second home buy. We've got English Home and English Garden. And we also cover what you'll be doing in your spare time when you're pushing on towards having a bit more spare time after the kids have grown up. So we have quite a few marine titles, classic boats, sailing today, yachts and yachting. So I think there is actually quite a nice arc. It's maybe something we don't make enough of. And I shouldn't think there's many publishers with that wide a range.
And the company describes itself as a boutique publisher. What does that mean? What is it, because it's London-centric and there's a narrow kind of geographic area, or is it the titles themselves?
It's funny to say that. So I looked this up, what is a boutique publisher? And it says it's a relatively small firm that provides a limited range of brackets, usually very specialized goods or services. And then something that I want to put away here says often at premium prices, you know, and I want to get away from that completely. But actually, my take on that is that, okay, from someone looking from the outside in into publishing, yes, well, maybe we are a boutique business. But in reality, in media, we offer a very wide range of services, as I alluded to earlier, you know, with the 20 plus print products and 15 digital sites, and then obviously all of their attendant social. And we also do creative content. We're very big in data. We've got huge data lists. And I think personally that we are, if we're a boutique publisher, we're right at the very top of that size.
So you've got 15, 20 titles, but you've got, what, about 100 staff, is that right?
Yeah, just under that. We are in two premises here on the King's Road, and then we're also in Cheltenham as well, a smaller office there. Yeah.
You're curious, you've maybe got the trajectory running the opposite way than some might expect. You've got group publisher with Dennis, and then you were with Lad Bible, and then you know you've gone to this boutique publisher. What's that like? What's the changes and the challenges of working at a smaller outfit now?
To be honest with you, I feel extremely lucky. I was at Dennis during a fantastic period of massive growth on titles that were just hugely successful. And actually from that group of people, it's really nice to see where everyone is now and how well everyone's doing. But when I left Dennis, I wanted to do something slightly different. You know, I've been at Dennis 15 years. And when the opportunity to go to Lad Bible to head up Sport Bible came up, I just knew I couldn't turn that down. After leaving there, I, to be honest, was kind of looking to try and recreate some of that entrepreneurial spirit maybe that we had at Dennis in those earlier years in my career. And Chelsea really felt like a good fit for that. You know, it's a business where, because the owner Paul is so hands-on, it feels a little bit like Felix used to be at Dennis. And I was looking for that again, really, where you had a direct line to the owner and actually could get things done quickly. And I think what we've shown here since I've been here and over the last couple of years is that if we think a project good, we will just do it. And with the sort of polarization of a lot of the bigger media companies, projects there are taking longer and longer to get out the gate. Whereas somewhere like Chelsea, if we see an opportunity and I can prove that there is going to be an ROI on that at some stage down the line, we will just go ahead and do it. One of the downsides of that, from a personal point of view, I suppose, is that the success or failure of that project is entirely on my head if I'm the one that's put it forward. Whereas a bigger publisher, you know, success has many fathers and failure only has one. And we, at the bigger publishers, I can see this time and time again for some of the projects that I'm aware of, people claiming that success and then shrinking away from the potential failure. Whereas here, it's very obvious whose project it is.
So in a smaller business like that, does that mean that you become also responsible, not just for implementation? Because we think sometimes a publishing, you know, digital publishing director is the guy that gets something done in terms of plugging the cables in. In a smaller business, are you much more sort of responsible for actual creative ideas, strategic thinking?
The great thing about this role and us being a slightly smaller business is that I've got my opportunity to do a huge number of things within the business, primarily because we don't have people with that dedicated job function. So I have really been trying to fill quite a few roles, right through from SEO and content creation to, as you mentioned, plugging in cables occasionally. But I've also got digital monetization attached to my name, and I've brought in both programmatic and affiliate revenue since I started here. But then also looking at some of the wider strategic plays on some of our brands, and actually what it's turned out to be really is the prioritisation of that, because there's just no way we can do everything that we need to. So the big piece that we've done over the last couple of months is getting buy-in from the board and from the rest of the company into what our priorities are going to be from a digital point of view. So it's a great role in the sense that I can really get involved from every element of the brand. The difficulty of that is just how do I manage my time?
It's part of the challenge here. You know, I mean, I know Chelsea Magazine companies bought or launched 10 titles in the last 5 years. When you're buying, when there's an acquisition involved, you could be buying something that's really, really advanced digital, or you could be buying something that's got nothing going on digitally.
Yes,
is
absolutely.
Is that part of the challenge, that you're working at other, you're working at both ends of the spectrum, basically?
Yes, it is. It's kind of never been a better time to acquire publishing titles. You know, there's loads of products out there that we get a sniff of or generally approached about. And, you know, even at Dennis, we bought titles that didn't fit with, you know, how we built our websites then, and actually ended up remaining a problem throughout their lifespan. So I think ongoing from here, if there is an acquisition available, then we're going to look very carefully about how that fits, because we just don't have the resource really to manage something that isn't built the same way the rest of our sites, or isn't an easy transfer project onto the way that we want our sites built.
See, and that idea that, you know, you talked about launch experience going back to Dennis, and Dennis is still actually, you know, one of the fewer publishing companies that is still launching titles.
Yeah, I know.
We had Karen O'Connor on for our 100th episode talking about the Week Junior.
Yes.
So Dennis has always been quite, you know, forward thinking in that. And you were obviously at Dennis for 15 years. You must have seen a lot of launches. How's that whole process changed?
Dennis have always launched lots of titles. And actually, I was part of the launch team for the original children's titles, because there was no experience of children publishing at all at Dennis. And we launched a couple of products a few years before the Week Junior. And, you know, I think with where they are now, I can't imagine that they would take the risk that we did when we launched something like Minecraft. It was kind of an interesting process. And we got that done within probably 3 months, if I'm honest with you. And that started with me seeing Minecraft for the first time. I'd never seen, never heard of it, at the London Book Fair, and ended up with us selling 100,000 MacBooks at £10 each. And the end of that was we actually doubled down and then went into a regular monthly, basically comic. And it was huge. You know, the first couple of issues that we did were absolutely enormous. And this had built on a couple of previous children's titles that we'd done. What we probably hadn't done is forecast what might happen if the publisher of the game changed ownership, which is exactly what happened when Microsoft bought Mojang further down the line. But prior to this, Mojang had actually ended up sending us a letter saying we couldn't use any screenshots for the game. So that's quite hard to publish a product about one game when you can't use any screenshots from it. And it actually ended that I left during this period, but they had to cease publishing. But further down the line, Microsoft bought Mojang and then apparently got back in touch and said, no, go ahead. You know, there's no such thing as bad publicity. I can't imagine that many publishers would not try and foresee something like that in the future. But there was lots of launches that we did at Dennis that were basically developed out of existing products. And I think that that's really the opportunity here at Chelsea as well. Yes, we'd like to launch a pure play digital product, but it's more likely that we're going to develop out of one of our existing markets or one of our existing brands. The great thing now, I think, that wasn't there around 10, 15 years ago, was that it's much easier to assess a site's traffic and therefore its revenue potential, because that information, that data is just more readily available. And, you know, when there were acquisitions coming into Dennis a while ago, you know, to be honest, some of the traffic figures that we were given as part of the due diligence just turned out to be pie in the sky. I don't think we would get caught with that again.
So if you've got a brand that you think is not, it's not quite what you thought it was going to be, particularly, I guess, if it's particularly the print aspect of it, how do you then go about either reviving it or at least sustaining it and getting some value back?
I think my biggest frustration really in media is to see a brand close when I know that there is another way to have kept that brand going. And one of the things we had to do at Dennis is to look at, could we reduce the cost base but keep that product going. And it, the original plan with some of them was that they would end up being turnover projects rather than profit projects. But actually, it ended up with a couple of them turning in a couple of years of really decent profit. So what we essentially established is what we ended up calling the franchise business model. So we would look at all of the cost base of a product, and it was normally those that were strong in print and weak digitally, and just see if there was a way that we could reduce that cost base and keep the product going. So products such as Micromart, MacUser, 14 Times and Bazaar had all reached a point with their in-house print production teams, editorial teams and all the other associated costs of a big West End publisher, that it just wasn't worth us continuing to do them. So we put together a model where we essentially franchise out the entirety of the content to a single person, and we would pay them on a monthly retainer, and they would have to provide us with print-ready PDFs. And it worked spectacularly well, and it meant that from a business point of view, we were able to buy that brand some time, in a couple of cases, to then further develop the digital offering so that when the time came on print, where even the franchise model couldn't keep it going, we then had a significant digital project. Or it meant that we could just keep that turnover coming, keep it into the business and keep that skill set within the business of the people that were involved on making that happen. So with something like MacUser, we ended up re-employing a previous editor who took it on, set up his own business and did it that way. And actually the MacUser product was the best it had been in probably 5 or 6 years when we moved it out of house and just said to Adam, go for it. Create the product that you want to. We are completely trusting of you. We are giving you this product. Make it what you want. Get back to basics. Concentrate on that and provide us something spectacular. And actually that's exactly what happened with MacUser. With 14 Times, I think it's fair to say that the editorial team, to be honest, probably were happier working from home than they were in that West End environment anyway, and they didn't have to get involved in all of the corporate stuff that you do at a big company. They could just content create and concentrate on writing about kind of the subjects that 14 Times readers wanted. And that product is still going, it's still doing well, and it's probably never been more focused. Where there was a time where it lost a little bit of its focus because some of the production guys were working on other titles, the editor was getting dragged into internal meetings, all of that stuff that comes with, you know, a big publishing house and a big office. So it was a great way, and there's nothing that annoys me more when I see another print title close and then I look at the flannel panel at the front of it, I see a huge number of staff, and I think, well, if they looked at that from another angle, they could potentially have at least given some of those guys that they may have had to make redundant some form of income for another couple of years and kept that title going, and then looked at how to build that title, you know, from the ground up digitally and socially. It's a frustration that is repeated over and over again.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we love 14 Times. Chris and I talk about 14 Times all the time. Yeah. It just is what it is, and I think I've got this mental image of the editors of 14 Times sat in a boardroom listening to some,
yes,
like you say, some corporate meeting, and it's really funny. Bizarre.
Yeah, absolutely, and it just didn't work. And what's brilliant about that franchise model is that it enabled the title to carry on, because if we hadn't have done that, that title would have closed. You know, that title would have closed. And there are loads and loads of brands out there, particularly really niche brands, that should look at that as a model for continuation, particularly if they are incurring a huge amount of cost that really isn't their, you know, isn't the brand's team fault, you know, just by sitting in that West End office. And I keep saying West End, it's, you know, obviously it's any publisher, wherever they may be. But when we broke down the figures on 14 Times, then, yeah, it clearly didn't make sense.
It's having historic fixed costs, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, fixed costs you maybe don't need anymore.
No.
So before you came to Chelsea, you were at Lad Bible. I don't want to get into the ins and outs of what went on there, but just, you know, in terms of what was that experience like coming from legacy brands, established brands, and then going on to something like Lad Bible, and you know, the Lad Bible Unilad story is famous, but what did you learn from that?
Well, to be honest, it was a completely different environment, and that's something that I wanted. I learned that to be beholden to a single platform is not a good thing. You know, Lad Bible was completely beholden to Facebook, and I was aware of that from the moment I joined and tried to build out the website to sort of combat that reliance on Facebook. And now at Chelsea, you know, I'm pleased that we're not beholden to a single platform, whether that is the newsstand or subscriptions or digital revenue or social platform, whatever, because it's a very difficult place to be. Whilst you may think that, you know, you're friends with Facebook or whichever platform that you are, you know, getting most of your income and traffic from, they have no obligation to keep you in the loop of when a huge change is coming, as per the one that came in March of last year, that saw traffic from that referral source absolutely plummet and never recover. And if anything, it crystallized in my mind that diversification within reason of both your revenue and your traffic is absolutely imperative. I think one of the things at Chelsea that we need to be careful of is that we haven't diversified too far in the sense of the amount of different platforms that we are trying to maintain. And what I'm conscious of is that we are probably, in fact, definitely working, putting too much effort into some sources because there are members of the team that like that platform. Mm. And that I see repeated time and time again. I did some consultancy and I saw that. And it's something that we need to iron out because, you know, I tried to look at Top Buzz as a source of traffic. But, you know, do we have the team to maintain that? No. Would we like to do Snapchats on some of our brands here? Yes, we would. Do we have the team to do that? No. And it's just about striking that right balance. Lad Bible were all in on Facebook and have now had to look at Instagram at least as a secondary source of that traffic, although I appreciate the complications there. Whereas at Chelsea, we are spread too thin and we need to narrow it a little bit. So if I learned anything there, it was just to make sure that effort is focused in the right areas.
So the last question we always ask our guests is there a piece of media that they've seen or listened to or read lately that they would recommend to our listeners?
Absolutely. For me, the greatest print product in the world is Sports Illustrated, and religiously buy that when I go to and from the States. And actually now you can pick that up at major travel, you know, so Waterloo, major train stations. And for me, that's everything that I want in long form journalism. I find it interesting. I find it emotional. And there's enough of the writer's personality coming through to make me want to go back and buy that. Now, it's interesting, I think, for someone that's so digital to say that, but I'm always looking for a way of trying to get that level of journalism into a digital product. And for me, that's the absolute gold standard of editorial, to be honest with you, and with writer-led content. I just think it's fantastic. It's my escape. It covers my commute and my my journeys around, because that is how I get my information on American sport. And I just feel that I would love to see that level of journalism replicated in some of the UK sports products.
Don't forget that in addition to the podcast, we also put out a weekly newsletter, which contains links out to everything we've been writing and reading from around the web, a link to the latest episode, and much more besides. You can go to voices.media to sign up for that.
And all the stuff we've discussed this week featured first in our Twitter feed. Basically, if you follow us on Twitter at Media Voices Pod, you can be kept up to date with pretty much everything that breaks in the media industry and all the best opinion pieces.
And we know exactly who we want to talk to, but we're actually also interested in who you want us to be talking to. So if there's any ideas that you have for guests for Media Voices, get in touch, let us know, and we'll try and track them down. Contact details are on the website.
@voices.media.
All right.
Until next week, when we are going to be back with a very fantastic guest, I can guarantee that. Thanks very much for listening to Media Voices, and goodbye.
Ta-ta. Stop Brexit.